Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be with you here today and to have such a good crowd. I'm sure that the sandwiches help. And my recollection is that if you put out food, students will show up. So that's outstanding. We are here for a very special purpose today, aside from the fact that I'll offer some remarks in a few minutes. And that is on behalf of the American Nuclear Society, as its vice president and president-elect, I'm going to present the charter for the school's establishment of a student section here at Vanderbilt. And actually, I'd like to have the other officers also come up. So if you would, Brooke and Pat, can you come up? And Dr. Clark, would you mind joining us up here as well? Well, that's all right. I left my tie on, too, so yes. I think
should we get on either side?
That's fine, either way. So on behalf of the American Nuclear Society and its 11,000 members, and speaking specifically for its board of directors, I'm very happy to present to you the charter of the student chapter of the American Nuclear Society at Vanderbilt University. Okay, thank you. I would like to say a couple of remarks, particularly about the charter itself. I'm going to say some comments later about the American Nuclear Society, and I'll save those till late in my presentation. But the establishment of the student section, we have just switched terminology from chapter to section relative to student group, so pardon me if I stumble over those two terms. But the establishment of a student section here at Vanderbilt marks a particularly unique milestone because there are about 26 other student sections of the American Nuclear Society at other schools, all of which offer a degree program in nuclear engineering. Now, they're not all nuclear engineering departments. About two-thirds are, but about one-third are degree-granting programs in another department of engineering, for example, mechanical engineering. You are unique here in that you have the first student section that's established at a department and a university that does not actually grant a degree in nuclear engineering. However, the importance of what you do here in the environmental area is key to the future of the nuclear engineering enterprise, particularly as it relates to nuclear power, but also to medical applications as well. All forms of nuclear application involve radioactive material, and that radioactive material must be handled carefully and ultimately disposed of in a responsible manner. And so the preservation of the environment and the compatibility of those materials with the environment is key to the success of that whole enterprise. So I'm very pleased that you've seen fit not only to establish a very unique curriculum here, one in which I think should receive a great deal of notoriety in the education community, but also I'm very pleased to see the enthusiasm on the part of the students in establishing this student section. And as I've learned over a very pleasant earlier discussion with them, getting out and communicating with other groups as well within your areas of expertise. So I want to congratulate you very much on that. I'm going to be very happy to convey back to the society through its board of directors, to whom I report and will present a report in June at the annual meeting about what you've done here, because I think it's very noteworthy, and I'm also anxious to see some reporting of what we've done here today in our communication vehicles within the society. So congratulations to you. Again, a hand for the students and their faculty advisors. What I would like to do in the next, do we really have till 3? I mean, is that, it's fine with me.
I can.
Okay. I see. Well, as long as the sandwiches.
We want to hang out and talk with you afterwards.
For about the next 45 minutes to an hour, what I'd like to do is give you a little bit of information about what's going on, particularly in the nuclear power industry, in what we call a nuclear renaissance. This is an increased interest today in the establishment of new nuclear power electricity production facilities. As you'll see later in my talk, there are a certain number of facilities in this country and worldwide, but there's a lot of interest both here and elsewhere in adding to those facilities for two reasons primarily. One being the increased demand for power, and we'll speak a little bit more about that. But the other, near to your hearts, is the environmental favorable attributes of nuclear power as compared to other means of generating electricity. So if I can get this to advance. This is the spectrum today of fuel sources that we have for electricity production. I actually should have given you a little quiz before putting this up. Honest Engine, how many of you, by a show of hands, knew that half of the electricity in this country is generated by coal? Okay, so in an environmental organization, I guess I should have anticipated that being the response. I want to tell you that if I were to go to a high school, which during my period of time with Texas A&M I did very frequently, we had a very active recruiting program in high schools, and both I and members of my faculty would go out to high schools, and I sometimes would speak to as many as 500, 600, or 700 students in a day. You know, they would just trot through hour after hour, and I'd have, you know, maybe 100 or more in the room at a time, and I would ask them the question, where does your electricity come from? What fuel is used to produce your electricity? Rarely, and in some cases through a whole day, never, would I get the answer coal. They just don't know that. Frequently, and most generally, I would get the answer solar, wind, hydro, renewables, and so forth, because these are the things that are on people's minds as what they think the future is, and they assume that that's what we're doing today. But the fact that we generate half of our electricity by coal is obscure to what I would say, by my sampling, is the vast majority of high school students. And I find that very disappointing. I think they need to realize where their electricity is coming from and what the consequences are of that. But you answered very well, and I would expect that. The other fraction, the other half, about 80% of it, divided more or less 20% each, is between nuclear energy and natural gas. And nuclear energy is going to be the principal talk subject, but I want to say just a couple of words about natural gas. What is the other major application of natural gas that you can think of besides generating electricity? Actually, there's two other major applications. Can you name one of them? Yes. Excuse me? Yes, home heating, or more generally, home and process heating. Because in industry, there's a lot of natural gas used, for example, for furnaces and so forth. What's the other application, though? Excuse me? Yes. You're kind of on the fringe of the general question that I'm trying to get answered. What's the other general application of natural gas? Well, it's a feedstock in the chemical industry. Okay, females who are in the room, any of you wearing makeup? Okay, well, you don't have to answer that. I didn't mean to be too personal. But your makeup depended upon natural gas as a feedstock. Petroleum products, and in particular natural gas, are a very important feedstock for many of our man-made products. Okay, and so the chemical industry, and coming from the state of Texas, as I did until most recently, the chemical industry is very upset with all this burning of natural gas because it's really taking away a major resource for them. And what that's done is it's driven the price of natural gas up from what was less than 10 years ago, about $2 per million standard cubic feet, to it's hit as high as $10 and $11 recently. So while everybody thinks of natural gas as a very inexpensive source of electricity production, that has become less true. And in fact, many utilities, and of course this is only used for peaking, you never use it for base load, but you all know what the difference is there, base load is it's just sitting out there generating electricity on and on at a particular level. Peaking is trying to follow the swings of demand during a day. And natural gas is a very poor resource for doing this because it's siphoning off what would have been an important application in the chemical industry, and it's driven prices up to where even the utilities now find this very unattractive. So they only use it when they absolutely have to. Hydro accounts for about 7%, and as you're probably aware, we're about tapped out in rivers in the United States that can really be economically applied for hydroelectric production. And right now, renewables, which includes solar, wind power, geothermal, biofuels, only accounts for about 3% of our electricity production, and only in very specialized locations. And most of that, by the way, is in the form of individual home applications where they actually backfeed electricity onto the grid. So that's where most of that comes from. It's not actually base load power. So that's our picture today. And there's a little tiny bit of oil. Most of that is being phased out as well. And let's focus then really on the nuclear part, because nuclear has the attributes of providing 20% of our electricity without emission of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. But as you're well aware, also carries with it a fair amount of public perception issues and questions about various topics associated with its application. So 104 power plants now operating in the United States, nuclear power plants. As you can see, they're largely focused located on the eastern half of the country, principally east of the Mississippi. And there's a few out in California and a couple or three precisely in Arizona. Why do you think they're distributed the way they are? Why do you think they're distributed that way?
Water's
an answer. It's not a driving answer, unfortunately. Population density, precisely. In fact, if I were to put a map up here of the coal-fired power plants in the United States, it would look very similar. There'd be more of them, but you would have a similar distribution. Because where the very high concentrations of population are, Illinois with Chicago particularly, and all up and down the eastern seaboard, actually all driving down into Florida now as well, tremendously high population density. Much less population density in the midsection of the country, largely agricultural area, huge expanses of fields growing all of our food, the Rocky Mountain area with even less population density and challenges for distribution of electricity across it, and then out in the east or the west coast area. There should be, if you really were to look at this logically, should be a lot more nuclear power plants there. But concerns there, principally with respect to seismic qualifications, reduce the number of those, although that's now being rethought. But 104 presently operating. There has not been a new nuclear power plant order in this country since 1978, and the last nuclear power plants that were licensed and put into operation actually were in the state of Texas in 1992 and 1993 at the Comanche Peak site near Dallas. So we've had a great deal of inactivity in terms of new plant establishment here in the United States, and that's been generally true worldwide. If I scale this number up, there are about 440 operating units in the world, but there are about 33 new plants under construction worldwide now, and I'll give you some further figures on that in a few minutes. Now, demand of electricity continues to rise, and there's two drivers for this. What would you think are the two drivers for rising demand in electricity? This is true worldwide, by the way. Increased population, of course. What's the population growth rate in the United States now? Anybody have a kind of a handle on that? It's on the order of 1% per year. It's about 0.8% per year right now. Where would you see much higher increases in population than that worldwide? China, India, generally Southeast Asia, the Pacific Rim, they have growth rates of population that go up as high as 3, 4, and 5% per year. So if this were driven strictly by population, for those parts of the world, this line goes up quite a bit in slope. What's the other driver besides just population? Yes, well, that's right. Technology, lifestyles, standard of living. I like to do this when I go to high schools. How many in the room, raise your hand and keep them up, have a television in your house? Okay. Really, some of you don't? Okay, thank you. Okay, oh, no, keep them up. If you have a television in your house. Okay, how many have two? How many have three? Oh, you're an unusual group. Four? I'll tell you, in the Dr. Clark. Keep going. Aha. Well, Dr. Clark represents a much larger number that I would see at those high schools that I go to, and I always can get up to at least six there. And then I don't embarrass anybody to go much further. Even in this country, with our high standard of living and our high level of affluence, we are insatiable in our appetite for more technology, and most of that technology is powered by electricity. So you can think of things, I've got this remote here, you have one for opening your garage door, some of you have them for opening and closing the blinds on your windows in your house, you have them for, I just put in a gas fireplace in my new home in North Carolina, and I have a remote for it, so I don't even have to turn the gas on and off except for using some sort of an electric device. The point is that population and technology drive this line, and this, while it shows a 40% increase by about 2030, these are Department of Energy figures in this country, that line goes up dramatically worldwide, and the projections for mid-century are for at least double the amount of electricity production that we have now being required by that time. So huge opportunities to challenge us to figure out how to generate all of this electricity. In this country, one of the ways of rising to that challenge is that we have actually, even though no nuclear power plants have been ordered since 78 and the last ones were installed in 92 and 3, we've actually added to the grid the capability equivalent to 26 new nuclear power plants in this country during the past 15 years. How do you think we've done that? Fixed population. We've actually only added one new nuclear power plant since 92-3, and that was one that was a plant that had earlier operated and then was refurbished and was restarted last year at Browns Ferry. But what do you think has allowed us to increase the productivity, so to speak, what we call the capacity factor of plants to this level? Yes, precisely. Reducing the downtime. Well, it's actually, you're thinking thermodynamics, I think, and not so much that, although some have raised their temperatures a little bit. But mostly it is that downtime question. We used to have power plants that would run only 70% of the year, some as low as 50%. They would have long refueling outages. They would have long downtimes for equipment refurbishment if that were required. Nowadays, the industry average capacity factor last year was 92%. In other words, they operated for 92% of their theoretical output through the whole year. And the other factor is that we've increased the power output of many nuclear power plants. When I was with Exelon in Chicago, I went to hearings before the NRC and the ACRS and presented evidence that it was acceptable to raise the power output of one unit by 20%, two other units by 19% each, and another two units by 16% each. Add all those up across the country, and the combination of increased power output and reduced downtime or increased capacity factor has added the equivalent of approximately a quarter of the fleet that we have right now, to the grid. A nuclear power plant is licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and it's licensed for 40 years. You get a driver's license, and it's valid for something like 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, you can renew your license. And if you're young, you can just renew it. And if you're older, you have to go in and prove that your eyes still work and maybe even take a test. And if you're older yet, you have to take a driver's test. Okay, actually go drive your vehicle. In a nuclear power plant at 40 years, you can renew the license, but you have to present a huge amount of evidence that the systems of that plant are sufficiently robust that they can be continued to operate beyond the 40 years. So These are the times and the number of plants in each year that the current fleet of 104 plants licenses would expire were no other action taken. And as you can see, by the time we would get out to mid-century, we wouldn't have any of these operating at that point. However, what's happened is all plants are expected to go for license renewal. They can get a renewal for 20 years, and they can actually go for another 20 beyond that, and they would have to go through the same justification. In all cases, there's a huge amount of engineering required to support that, and in most cases, there are major equipment upgrades and refurbishments that are done in order to support that. What happened there? Didn't know I hit that. This should reverse, but something reprogrammed itself in my computer. There we go. So as we speak, about half of the units have been relicensed by the NRC. Another 20% of them are undergoing review today, and others are expected to follow. So all of those plants that you saw are expected to have at least another 20 years and probably another 40 of operating lifetime. I don't know why this is doing that. Unless, if you want to do that,
yeah,
that would be fine.
Okay.
So what's driving our thinking about adding new nuclear power plants? This is a little balloon chart that shows the different factors that are at work here. The three at the top involve government. Okay. In the middle of the picture at the top is the Congress of the United States. And in 2005, in October, they passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which provided certain stimuli for the nuclear power industry to get going, as it were. As you probably are aware, the federal government and even state governments provide stimuli to all different kinds of industries all the time. This is nothing unusual. And what they did is they put out some things called loan guarantees, which would help utilities if they were to take out a loan to build a new plant, that they would not be left holding the bag if there were some sort of unforeseen delay. So there was a guarantee that they could get the loan. Production tax credits, these are credits for actually producing electricity in a clean, environmentally acceptable way. And then standby support if, in fact, there were some form of unforeseen delay, as sort of an insurance policy. At the same time, the Department of Energy went forward with a Nuclear Power 2010 program, which is a cost-sharing program for the first half dozen new units, where they're going to work with the utility and establish the paperwork, basically, not actual hardware, but the paperwork for applying for a new nuclear power plant. And then the NRC completely revised its licensing process, and we think introduced a improved regulatory stability so that this process will go much more smoothly. All of those came into position at about the same time, 2 to 3 years ago. Now, in response to that, the various reactor vendors also produced a number of new designs, and it's those new plants that now that are a little different, and I'll tell you some of their aspects, than the ones that currently operate that are now being considered by utilities. Utilities were faced with new power demand, an increased willingness by the financial community to provide backing. Up until perhaps 5 years ago, if one had a nuclear power plant on your balance sheet, that was actually viewed unfavorably by the financial community because there was a fear that that was going to be what they call a stranded asset, one that would create a financial drain on the utility. Now, with the plants running as well as they are and running at high capacity factors, all the financial institutions have, in fact, viewed nuclear power plant assets very favorably. And they also are able to get what's called an early site permit, which means you can apply to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for siting a plant and get a review way before you have to actually invest money and build the plant. And then we're always, of course, looking at what's going on elsewhere in the world. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of international activity. In fact, there will be more nuclear power plants built outside the United States in the same time period than there are within the United States in the next 1 to 2 decades, because there's already a huge momentum underway. I mentioned there's about 30 new plants already being built. India actually has 7 underway right now. Russia has 5. China has 5. And China is going to have a huge program. They're going to build a lot of coal plants, but they're also going to build a lot of nuclear plants because they have such a huge population that's growing, and its standard of living and its use of technology is so small compared to what we enjoy here in the United States that they're trying to improve that. Okay. It worked, yeah. Just a couple of words about the NRC's licensing process. There's the early site permit, which allows a utility to bank for a 20-year period a site. Nearly all new plants that are being considered now, in fact, will be built at a location where there already are plants, but they're looking at other sites as well. Exelon, the company I used to work for, in fact, has a new site in the state of Texas that they're applying for a permit to have a plant there. This combined construction and operation license, the licensing process formally for all the plants currently operating was a two-step process. You got a license to build, and then some years later you got a license to operate. That caused a great deal of financial burden because at the point where applications were made to operate, a lot of intervention was made by anti-nuclear groups, and it turned out that they were very successful in the courts in holding up the issuance of that operating license. Utility, meanwhile, had invested a lot of money, had a big plant sitting out there ready to go, but wasn't producing any income because they weren't allowed to operate yet. Now the NRC provides a combined construction operating license. The public has its opportunity for intervention, but that intervention takes place before major money has been invested in actually constructing the plant. And then the other leg of the triangle is this design certification. The new designs by the vendors are being reviewed by the NRC, and they are standardized, much as the French have done with their nuclear fleet. And they basically issue a approval of a design, and then that can be used over and over again by either a utility or multiple utilities. So a lot of time savings, a lot of improvement in the understanding of the safety of the system and the replication of that safety at different sites. So what did that produce? 2005, Congress passed the Energy Policy Act of 2005. This slide is actually from an NRC meeting in early 2006 in March. And at that point, there had already been announced about 30 combined operation and construction license applications. And the NRC used this slide. It showed 3 of the advanced designs that were currently being looked at by utilities from different reactor vendors. And it shows all of the different utilities that had made announcements that they were going to proceed forward with an application for a new plant. Is there a light right at the front there? I have a sense that, I wonder if that one's the one. One of these is. Maybe not. Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, I apologize. I think those yellow letters are probably a little hard to read. That may be too much. There we go. Okay, thanks. So this is an eye test. Just kidding. That's right, and I'll come back to that. I was going to come back to that. This is a detailed chart, and it shows the different companies that have made announcements. It shows the nuclear power plant design that they have elected. It shows the number of units that they've currently announced, and the to-be determines are that they've said they're going to build at least one, or they're going to apply to build at least one, and it may be more. And in some cases, we know that more is up to 3 or 4. And this shows when they plan to submit their combined operating license application. Okay. The first one was submitted in September of 2007. It was submitted by a company called NRG, which actually is an investment firm. They operate, or they own, and others operate 2 plants in what's called the South Texas Project in Bay City, Texas. And they elected to add 2 more units. And it turns out that the type that they elected to add is not actually one on the NRC's chart. It's a 4th one, which actually has been built and operated in Japan and is built by General Electric Company. And they were seen as being very innovative in electing to go to that design. It is an advanced design, but it wasn't one of the ones that the vendors were pushing. It's sort of like if you went down to the Toyota dealer and you said, gee, I'd really like to get a Camry, you know, and they said, well, I'm only really pushing Senecas this year, you know, that's what I really want you to buy. It turns out that General Electric's gotten surprised, because you can see the number of this type now, this is as of January, that have lined up and said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'd like to work with that design. So as of today, 4 applications were made in 2007, some for multiple units, and another application has just come in February, and you can see the remainder are all expected either this year or next year. Huge workload. I learned from some of your students that you're electing to take jobs with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is trying to hire upwards of 300 to 350 people per year. Their target is to have at least a quarter of those be new graduates. So there's huge opportunities with them, with the reactor vendors, and frankly with many utilities, because each one of these applications is a huge undertaking in terms of the amount of engineering and design description and so forth that has to go in. So this is sort of a box score. 17 companies are currently involved, at least 33 reactors, 4 new designs have been certified, and 3 more are currently under review. So there'll be at least 7 new designs that the NRC will have approved. 4 early site permits. All of the first ones that were applied have been issued as of this date, and there's 6 more companies considering other applications. Industry expenditure, this probably needs to be updated, because I put this particular piece of data together last fall, but somewhere between $2 and $2.5 billion has been spent by the industry thus far on these individual applications. Yes?
Yeah, since you have 7 different designs, it really doesn't look like you're standardizing.
Each of those individual designs is a standardized design, and the market will tell us how many of those really get applied. Right now, only 4 of them have been considered in all of these 33 applications. So it's not as standardized as the French fleet, but it's better than the 104 individual designs, which literally is what we have in the country today. So your comment is correct, but it's a matter of degree, I guess I would say. In a free market where you have individual designers who want to put forward something for sale, probably the order of 4 to 7 is not unusual. In the French situation, it was all government controlled, and they literally have only 3 different designs, but the variation between them is really in power level and degree of sophistication in some of their INC instrumentation. You know, they're essentially the same. They're a Westinghouse design. As I said, 4 applications were submitted in 2007, 1 so far in 2008. So we're really moving along. I had another slide that I started to put together last night, and then I said, no, it was way too detailed. It was kind of a timeline of what's gone in since that first South Texas project, and it's amazing. I'm on a distribution list for the Nuclear Energy Institute that is an industry. It's both a lobbying and a promotion organization, and I mean, I get email from them every day as to new things that are happening. There's not a new application every day, but every week, practically, there's either a new application of one sort or another, or the NRC has now agreed that they have enough information on a particular application and they're starting in earnest on the review and so forth. Really a lot of momentum going on here. And this is the NRC's own chart. This was from a meeting actually just almost exactly a year ago. It will be updated here in another month, which shows their timeline of review. And you can see that they're in a crunch. Here we are in early 2008. Look what's happening over the next 4 years. They have a tremendous workload demand that they're going to be trying to respond to in order to review all these individual applications. Okay, hopefully that set the stage now for what's going on and why it's happening and the momentum that's associated with it. Now let me talk a bit about the challenges, because you in the university community, and particularly you as new students and students about to graduate, are thinking about, well, how can I solve problems? And you haven't told me about any problems yet. Okay, I'm going to tell you about the problems now. Not so much the problems, let's call them opportunities. Okay. This is my crystal ball. Someone else might give you a little different perspective. I would say that the ANS supports this through its activities as being a reasonable perspective, but I won't claim that it is absolutely, you know, the Bible on, you know, what are the problems. But I think it'll encompass the ones that most people would recognize. I've categorized these in three areas: infrastructure, public and political support, and nuclear waste management. In infrastructure, there are two major subcategories. One is to reestablish the nuclear infrastructure. Because of that inactivity, not having an order since 78, not having put a new plant online since 92, 93, a lot of people have left the business. Utilities have consolidated. Suppliers have consolidated. There are less of them. Most of the people you see out there look like me. They don't look like you, you who are the students. We have an aging workforce. We have a lot of people that have either retired or have actually just left the industry because it seemed to be somewhat stagnant. And so in all sectors, we need to reestablish the infrastructure. Huge opportunity for new graduates to get out there and invigorate many of these organizations. And this is one that I find particularly disturbing, determining where we're going to fabricate all of this new equipment. The technology that we use for building nuclear power plants today is very different than it was 30 years ago. And so, for example, a nuclear reactor is in a very thick steel vessel. And it used to be the way we made those vessels, which can be 8 to 10 inches thick, is we would take big plates and we would bend them, okay, into maybe an arc of a quarter circle. And then we would weld them together to make this big vessel, okay. And there's problems that are associated with that. Technology has advanced, and now we literally take a huge billet. You know what a billet is? I mean, it's basically just a big chunk of metal. And then, frankly, we push it around like silly putty, and we'll form major components out of one billet. I was in France recently, and I saw the ring of a reactor vessel that includes all of the nozzles that go in to bring in and take out cooling water. And that whole ring, which used to be a very complex piece of welding and putting together of a plate and nozzle components, is now made out of one piece of metal, one billet. It's called forging. And 30 years ago, we couldn't do that. Now we have the technology to do that. And all of the new designs employ that. Yes?
Is it true that we'll have to get all of our equipment in Japan because they're the only
two that have the infrastructure? Japan, France, South Korea, of course the Russians. Yes, all the equipment now being ordered, this big, heavy metal equipment, is being ordered through those sources. And in fact, while utilities are making these license applications, they're not waiting to build equipment. They're actually fabricating. When I was in France, I saw several vessels that were being fabricated for the United States. And it's very disturbing to me. And I think sometime, I speculate over the next decade, we're going to see some entrepreneurs step forward in the United States and say, okay, I'm going to put together a fabrication facility. But this is one that's a big problem. For public and political support, we have to have very high performance standards. We have to address what's called the proliferation concern. These are radioactive materials. They are materials that can fission, because that's the source of power for generating electricity. Fission is also the source of power in a nuclear weapon. So we want to make sure that the materials that are being applied in a nuclear power plant can't be diverted by someone and then applied in an adverse manner. And that's what that term proliferation means. And we need to continue to build the public confidence through the operating record of the existing plants. And then finally, in the waste disposal, several of you, I was very pleased to learn, are quite familiar with Yucca Mountain. You've even been there and visited. We need to establish our long-term nuclear waste disposal option. Right now, Yucca Mountain is the principal one being considered. And then ultimately, we really need to close the nuclear fuel cycle. We really need to take the fuel after it's been used in the reactor, chemically reprocess it, and actually then reestablish extraction of the remaining energy content and fabricate new fuel. That would then close the nuclear fuel cycle. So let me look at each of these just in a little bit of detail. These are some of the examples of infrastructure issues. One very close to home here is the DOE funding for nuclear education programs has actually reduced in the last 2 years. This is amazing. Fortunately, in its wake, the NRC has picked this up, and so the amount of funding available through at least government sources has remained reasonably stable over the last couple of years. We have knowledge and experience and labor shortages because of the aging workforce. Even the DOE's actions to implement the Nuclear Waste Policy Act have been delayed. There's been delays in applying for the Yucca Mountain Repository license. And even as recently as the Energy Policy Act, several of its elements have taken considerable period of time to put in place. Fortunately, they are all now in place. But in the case of the loan guarantees, that took 2 years after the actual act was passed. So these are issues that are being addressed, being resolved, but they're examples of what really is required to be able to go forward and build not only the 30 plants that are being talked about, but many more beyond that. I mentioned the fabrication thing. Somebody said something about Japan. This is Japan Steelworks. This is one of the vessel components that I saw. This is its completed form over at Japan Steelworks. You can see that it's basically the upper half of the reactor vessel with all of the nozzles in place, all having been fabricated out of a single billet of metal rather than being all welded together out of pieces. And I actually stood right next to this in France about 2 weeks after this picture was taken, and it was there in France for final machining, and when completed will be shipped to the United States for a new nuclear power plant at the Calvert Cliffs site in near Maryland. So this is just an example of what's being done elsewhere in the world, and we are now dependent upon that as our fabrication source. This is what's called the U.S. EPR number one, which will be the first design of this sort in the United States. On the public confidence front, these are some statistics that the NRC actually keeps, and these are measures that need to be maintained in order for the public to have its confidence. In the nuclear business, we always seem to deal in negatives. We always look at what could happen, what ifs. We look at counting of adverse things. So these are shutdowns of the plant without, while it's critical and operating, called a scram. These are equipment forced outages, and these are radiation exposures. And the good news is that you can see over this approximately 10-year period, each of these, so to speak, negative indicators has trended downward. And that is a very good thing. And the NRC, of course, and other industry groups, of course, measure these very regularly and report them. And this is part of what supports the increased performance that we've seen out of the existing fleet of the reactors currently. Proliferation. This is the question of whether or not materials could be diverted for an adverse purpose, particularly for a weapon. I want to be clear with you that there are two ways of approaching this. One is purely physical solutions, okay? And the most prominent of those is using barriers of guns, gates, and guards, as it's called. In other words, you keep the bad guys from getting in where the materials are and getting their hands on it. But at the same time, we can reduce the weapons-grade material by fissioning it in power reactors. It's an interesting statistic that about half of our electricity currently is produced by uranium that's been bought by the United States from Russia that was on the path to being a nuclear weapon in Russia. And that's now all been bought up by the United States, or a large chunk of it, and is now being resold to the utilities for blending down, as it's called, and put into reactors and burning it up as fuel. Advanced fuel cycles are known. They're being further developed, where we would, at the end of a fuel cycle, we would have less material that would be attractive for a nuclear weapon. Actually, in reality, most of it isn't attractive at all. There's much easier ways to produce weapon material. But we're now looking at these advanced reactors having fuel cycles that reduce the amount even further. And then literally removing weapon-grade material from the biosphere, burning it up in reactors, or in other ways, taking it out of the possible reach. And then there are political solutions where we would Ones that are on the table now are prohibiting reprocessing facilities in new countries, or different countries rather than currently have them, prohibiting enrichment facilities. You've heard all the controversy, for example, about Iran, and then establishing some sort of centralized world oversight. These are all in a program called the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, which the current administration in the United States has proposed. It's unclear whether or not that will be what's established worldwide, but at least they are political approaches to this issue. And I just want to highlight, how many of you have been to a nuclear power plant? How many? Raise your hand. Okay, so you've seen what I'm showing you up here. If you go to any nuclear power plant, you're going to see guns, gates, and guards. You're going to see a lot of protective measures, far more than what you would see in most industrial facilities. So what has this done in terms of public opinion? The trend has generally been improving. Approximately 70% of public polled today, and there's much more detail behind this summary chart, favors the establishment of more nuclear power plants, while the number that are opposed has steadily shrunk and is in the order of 30%. 70-30 or 65-35 is probably not bad for any major industrial expansion in terms of its favorable rating with the public, but it really requires continued safe and acceptable operation of the current reactors, and it really continues to demand a lot of communication amongst the industry to let the public know what's going on and make sure that they are still in a favorable opinion about nuclear energy. Yes? Well, in 1986 was the Chernobyl accident, and of course that had a very negative impact. But on the other hand, some of the events or some of the dips and swings in this are really unrelated to particular events. The public opinion sways for various reasons. I want to tell you that people who live near an operating nuclear power plant are the most favorably disposed to having new nuclear power plants. This is actually a set of slides by the mayor in Bay City, Texas. And they mentioned that that's a two-unit plant at the South Texas Project. They were the first recall to apply to the NRC for construction of two new plants. And these are slides that the mayor of that city actually developed himself and used in promoting public acceptance in that community for the application for these two new nuclear power plants. It's quite common that the people in the community are very accepting because the plant is a good neighbor. It provides a very major economic base, tax support for the community. It provides jobs, and in general, it does a lot of outreach activities, both in terms of social institutions and environmental. If you go to most nuclear power plants, you will find major environmental preserves that are set aside on land near the plant. I mean, one thing to assure public confidence in a plant is to have some distance between the plant and the population. Good thing to put in that space is some sort of an environmental preserve. And so you're going to find nuclear power plant management is generally looked at very favorably. So this is just representative of what a local community attitude is in nuclear power plants. So let me talk a little bit about this last area of nuclear waste disposition. Right now, every nuclear power plant, if you will, is a repository. All 104 plants currently have nearly all of the fuel that was ever used in the nuclear power plant at the site. It's either stored in massive swimming pools, which were originally designed just to hold spent fuel for a short period of time before it was shipped off to some reprocessing and then brought back into the plant as fresh fuel. Or it's located in above-ground storage canisters that are air-cooled. Generally, fuel is kept in a water-cooled environment for 5 years or more before it's actually then put up into an air-cooled system. But all of the fuel in the United States that's ever been used, except for a very small part at the very beginning, is still at nuclear power plants and quite secure there because of the type of activity for guns, gates, and guards that I told you about and showed you examples of. The current long-term storage solution that's being considered is this storage in Yucca Mountain in the state of Nevada. And eventually what we would like to see is a reprocessing of fuel. So taking the fissile material that's remaining and recycling it, transmuting the high-level waste into a non-radioactive form, and any residual waste vitrifying it, which means putting it in a glass matrix and keeping it out of the biosphere by isolating it in a stable environment. And you'd say, well, okay, if that's so obvious, why isn't it being done? Well, it is. This is being demonstrated currently in France, Russia, Japan, and previously, in fact, in the United States. And I think all of you in your studies undoubtedly have been exposed to information about how this can and is being done. I toured France for 11 days last October and saw the French facilities for recycling fuel and for preparing high-level waste for disposal and, in fact, their fabrication facilities, and it is just extremely impressive. The technology is certainly available. It's difficult to understand why in the United States we haven't continued to apply it. I'll admit that when we get back into the business, we're probably going to do it better than anybody else. But nevertheless, it's a bit of a mystery as to why we're not there today. Yucca Mountain is currently preparing its application in the NRC to be licensed for use. The application will be filed, we believe, this spring. They're very close, if not this spring, this summer. And it will permit the facility to be opened probably most optimistically in about 2017. I've seen various estimates that go out to maybe 2021. The biggest resistance to Yucca Mountain right now is political resistance in the state of Nevada, both from the governor's office and from the congressman's office. And I must admit, this is just me speaking now, it's a great mystery to me why that is such a quest on their part to resist having this facility. So for those of you who choose to get on the communication circuit, here's some ideas. The biggest concern expressed by the politicians in Nevada is that there would be a destabilization of the state's major source of income, which is gaming. That means gambling. I view it as establishing a waste repository in Nevada would have a great synergism with the Gaming Commission by stabilizing their tax base. Right now, Nevada is heavily dependent upon the gaming tax, which is very good. I mean, it's a very good source of income. But the gaming community is very concerned about the gaming taxes going up. If you had a repository there, which itself would pay major taxes, it would be a hedge against the gaming community's tax rate going up. So I would think it would be viewed with considerable political favor. I may be being naive and I'm missing something, but that's a thought. Certainly would be a big boost of local employment, just like what you have at a nuclear power plant site. It would certainly thrust Nevada into a position of national and, in fact, international leadership, because this now would be being examined for its use as a waste repository by people worldwide to learn from the experience and determine whether or not the United States has established something that would be emulated elsewhere. And I will submit there would be no negative impact on tourism. And I think I can prove that point by simply observing that for most of my lifetime, when I was your age as a student or younger, Nevada was the place where we were blowing up nuclear weapons. Okay? And I don't remember ever hearing that nobody went to Las Vegas in those days. In fact, that was the only place you could go to gamble in those days, because we didn't have casinos at every Indian reservation. So I will tell you that I think there would be no negative impact on tourism, because this is in the same proximity and certainly much more benign than blowing up nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, which we did for many years while the gaming industry was quite successful in attracting tourists. Well, the ultimate solution is to close the nuclear fuel cycle, and this is to mine the uranium or find the source perhaps in nuclear weapons that are being dismantled, bring it into a power plant, take the spent fuel out. This is actually a somewhat outdated term now. It should be really called used fuel or recyclable fuel. Reprocess it, bring the remaining recycled uranium and plutonium back in to fresh fuel to put in the plant, and put any residual products into some form of geologic repository. This is well known as a cycle, and except for the very final step of actually putting it in a repository, the French have every part of this step, as do the Russians, as do the Japanese, who, by the way, buy all their reprocessing currently from France, but have just opened a new facility where they themselves will be doing the reprocessing. And all of these pictures around the periphery are actually from my trip to France last year.